Hello, friends. Welcome to this month's episode of Chris Chambers Noir. Our topic today is how noir shapes crime fiction and the future trends. Our guest is Alex Kenna, a mystery writer, prosecutor, and amateur painter. Her first novel, What Meets the Eye, was a 2023 Seamus Award finalist for Best First PI Novels. Kirkus Reviews called it a righteous, painful debut, and we can't wait to hear more about that. Bookpage called her a master in the making, as she lives in LA with her husband, her son, and a giant schnauzer. Before law school, she studied art and art history, worked as a freelance culture writer for The Atlantic and other publications, and sold paintings in a gallery. When she's not writing, Alex can be found exploring Washington State, toddler wrangling, and playing string instruments badly. I totally can relate to that. Her new book is called Burn This Night, and we can't wait to hear all about what shapes crime fiction and future trends. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and you can also find us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple. And our videos are on Chris Chambers Noir TV on YouTube. I'm going to throw it over to Chris and Alex. Have a great time. We can't wait to hear all about this fantastic topic.
Thank you. Thank you. And again, welcome to Chris Chambers Noir on iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Incandescent Radio, and YouTube, where you can see my pretty face and everybody else. I'm the prettiest one, of course, because I am the host. It is a real treat to have this guest on. We're going to talk about the books. We're going to talk about What Meets the Eye and Burn This Night. And of course, the allegorical titles, because the first one relates to art and the second one relates to fire. But I have to share one thing I found out today. That Alex Kenna is a fellow Washingtonian. Hail to the Redskins.
Yeah, it's a wonderful town. I'd love D.C. It'll always have my heart.
Yes, I mean, you know, I should have brought on some mumbo sauce. I should have had some go-go music playing in the back. I should have, have some half smokes. We could, I could ship them out. You can eat those. Some crab cakes. I mean, it is great to see another child of Swift Potomac, although it's not that swift. There's more than ice floating in it now, if you've been following the news.
Yeah, it sounds like a mess.
It is a mess. And of course, our president blamed the governor of Maryland, even though the governor of Maryland said, no, you feds are the ones that have the responsibility for it. So that's kind of ironic that the president was claiming somebody else was full of shit. So, but we'll leave it at that. We're allowed to make those pronouncements here on my podcast. But it is so great to have you. And in addition to being a fellow Washingtonian, I mean, were you born in Washington?
I was born in LA, but we moved when I was little. So I grew up in DC. I lived there a little bit in my 20s, which it was a really fun time to be in your 20s in DC because everybody was doing interesting things. It was back in a time where, you could talk to people who disagreed with you and have a interesting conversation.
How about that? Right.
The DC that I remember is probably very different from we have now. And I do just want to correct one thing. I'm actually in Tacoma, Washington now. We moved very recently. So that's on me. I need to update my bio.
Well, you are now in the official Northwest. And I think we joked about Kate Jackson, who is up there and writes about Sasquatch, and we're going to have to talk about Sasquatch at the end.
Oh my God, he's everywhere. Yeah, I was not prepared for the Sasquatch culture, but it is real, and
it is amazing, isn't it? I mean, I of all the things up there that is so amazing up there in that area, this is the one thing. here it's Marion Barry, it's Sasquatch.
That's the motto.
Go figure.
And they got a lot of other, it's actually, I'd say Sasquatch and octopuses. There's like everywhere you go, everything's covered in octopuses. Apparently in Tacoma, they used to do octopus wrestling, which I just learned because we have giant octopuses. So that's a thing. Yeah.
You mean people and octopuses or two octopuses?
I think it's people and octopuses. This was one of those things where I heard it and like put a pin in it to go back and look into it because – it gets a little weird in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not going to lie. I had heard of Sasquatch, but I did not expect to see his illustrated picture everywhere I go.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. You know, I'm going to be at Left Coast Crime, this time tomorrow, and they don't call it the Left Coast for nothing. So from the Northwest down to San Diego, it is a whole different ball game. I just wanted to, this really wasn't the icebreaker. The icebreaker was, you know, you were nominated for a Seamus for What Meets the Eye. I've been nominated for those, and it's like being a bridesmaid. So my icebreaker is, have you ever been a bridesmaid? And is it really so wonderful and you're being selfless and you're giving of yourself to support the bride? Or is it really a big pain in the ass?
You know,
and you're so mad seeing somebody else win. Really, what give me your thoughts on that.
You know what? I actually haven't been a bridesmaid, probably because most of my close friends know that I think weddings are stupid. Like, my husband and I, you know, we're completely unromantic. I got married when my insurance ran out and he was working for a judge who married us at his lunch hour. And I wore an old dress.
Wow.
So, you know, and it happened to be Valentine's Day, which we forgot because we don't really do Valentine's Day. So, you know, we accidentally got married on Valentine's Day and as in an insurance shotgun wedding. There's a lot of politics, I think, in bridesmaidhood. And I'm a person who doesn't care. So I've had a couple friends be like, do you care if you're a bridesmaid? I'm like, you know, I don't want to go buy a dress. Do your thing. Invite other people. So, yeah, long story short, I have not been a bridesmaid. And I'm, you know, I'm happy to go to somebody's wedding and, you know, drink and take in the scenery. But, you know, that's enough for me.
Okay. I want to go back to insurance shotgun wedding.
Yeah.
I had to write that down. I might call like Chad Willemson and those guys because they could probably use that. Wes Brown and them in one of their stories. Because that sounds like, but I mean, some advice, you probably should. For the sake of your kid, say that you knew it was Valentine's Day to at least inject some kind of wonderment into it. You know, I mean, you know, some kind of whimsy and fancifulness, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's probably too late for that. The kid is very into whimsy. It's amazing how a dark sensibility is genetic. So, you know.
You're right.
Lots of werewolves, lots of monsters, he thinks mommy's a vampire sometimes, I can't say it's totally untrue. I don't think.
Well, I bet it helps when somebody's not ready to go to bed and you're like.
Oh, yeah.
But no, go ahead. Go ahead. I was interrupting the darkness of your genes and chromosomes transferring down to this new generation of noir writer. You know what? Who does the kid take after more, you or your husband?
Oh, he's like my clone. Which is, you know, he's like a very
good, by the way,
high maintenance neurotic kid in a good way. Very good. You know, he's smart. He's got other attributes. And every time he's especially annoying, my husband's like, he got his personality from you, which is true. He's kind of like my, you know, he's got different coloring. So he's like my little, you know, light eyed blonde clone. You know, but very into telling stories, very dark, interested in monsters and all that. And it's definitely interesting seeing how your genes end up spreading out.
Well, let me ask you this then. This is a good transition to monsters in a way. I was excited about you coming on the podcast because everybody I talked to about you when I met you at one of the BoucherCons, it was probably Minnesota, but definitely in New Orleans. But everybody says two things about you. You're one of the nicest people they've ever met. And you represent almost like the future of the genre. And nobody can really put their finger on that. It's easier, you know, obviously the nice part. I guess, I don't know, you know, cause you know, your kid could be right. You might have this other side, you know, we aren't seeing right here. It's always the quiet ones, you know, but in these two books, which are the Kate Miles for the audience, the Kate Miles series, PI, you seem to synthesize all of the elements of our various subgenres that agents and publishers like to silo us in. You seem to synthesize that together, but you put a nice noir cap, a nice noir flavor on it. And I don't mean, you know, just the setting and the mood and maybe the rough language, but, you know, you have a protagonist that ain't especially likable sometimes, or, you know, you have, you know, situations of moral ambiguity. I mean, that real philosophical noir. And that's what really just kind of excited me about, you know, having you on the show and just seeing, you know, and it put together in my mind what these other people were saying. And when I mean other people, I'm talking about, you know, the creme de la creme, you know, of our little happy crew.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, and even when I say that, I mean, I'm talking about the people who are pushing the envelope themselves. You know, they are, you know, so when you hear other people are pushing the envelope, say that you're pushing the envelope better, that must be really great for you. And I, you know, but here's the thing. I mean, is this something that you know, really kind of engineer into it? And this isn't one of these pantser versus outliner questions. I mean, do you really make a conscious effort to engineer that kind of synthesis into it? Or does it just come naturally? Because you are a painter. So in a way, you kind of are a pantser in some way. I mean, so what's your process in creating these stories? I mean, creating her and creating the plots and the characters around her.
It's kind of a combination. I think, you know, one thing, when I talked to you before, you had mentioned wanting to talk about women in noir. So, and I was, you know, I had kind of had that idea.
Oh no, we will.
But I think, for women in noir, and I think probably also for, you know, writers of color, there's more of an obligation to show your work when you're creating a character, because you can't rely as much on the trope. You know, if you're not writing, you know, this really hard boiled, you know, 40-year-old divorced, you know, police sergeant.
White guy.
You got to do something a little bit different. You're doing something different and you have to show why this is noir. So I think you're almost forced to make somebody really multidimensional. And I think if you're writing a woman who has flaws, you have to justify them. So you can't just, you know, like my character, Kate, she's not a perfect mother. She had an opioid addiction that after a car accident, lost custody of her kid. She's desperately working to get it back. If that's all you hear, a lot of readers are going to close the page, because we're obsessed with everybody being a good mother in our culture. Meanwhile, if she was a man, it would just be like, oh, okay. You know, it's like one of my favorite examples is like Ted Lasso, which is very entertaining. But if you... If you heard there was a show about like a woman who abandoned her kid and flew to the other side of the world to take a job, she was totally unqualified.
Yeah, it would be like, no.
You'd be like, great, how cute. No, I don't think so. So there's kind of this obligation where if you want to write a character who's very flawed and you don't fall into, you know, kind of the archetype, you got to show your work. So you have to make somebody really multidimensional. And I was kind of thinking about other women who write noir, and you have that. There's a lot of writers where you feel like the character is going to jump off the page. So I did put a lot of work into developing Kate. And I was also, when I was writing her, a part of it was COVID. I had changed jobs, and immediately after changing jobs, I ended up, you know, at home, like we all were. And there was just kind of this feeling of loss, you know, in transition. And I wanted to have a character who had basically had everything that gave her a sense of identity, suddenly get ripped away. And then she had to kind of build up from there. So, you know, and I'm attracted to people in real life who are multidimensional and have kind of gone through transitions. It's what interests me. It's who interests me. So, you know, those kind of all came together for her. In terms of the genre, I kind of think about it in terms of what do I want to talk about? What am I thinking about? What ideas do I want to put in there? And how can I use the structure of a mystery novel as an excuse? So, you know, with Burn This Night, I was thinking a lot about meth-induced mental illness, in part because I have someone in my life who basically destroyed their brain with meth. And I was a DA for a long time, and we'd see it in the courtroom every day. And there's this mental health epidemic that never gets talked about, in part because, you know, in part because people don't care as much as they should, in part because fentanyl is more deadly, but it's there. But you can't write a whole book about, you know, meth-induced insanity. Nobody's going to read that. But you can put it in as a thread into a mystery novel. And, you know, the structure, it lets you get you, it gives you, you have misdirection. People have backstories. It lets you, you know, kind of take all these kind of disparate elements and weave them together. So I kind of rely on that a lot. And I guess, you know, lastly, I have flaming ADHD. So, you know, in some ways, I think as a writer, it's a disadvantage because, you know, you need a lot, you need a flow. But I think in some ways it's an advantage because my brain naturally kind of ping pongs around. And I like complicated plots so that I don't get bored. If I just, the more kind of standard, you know, A, B, C, D plot with from one perspective, I think that would be harder for me to write because I would suddenly kind of, you know, ping pong around and start thinking about a different character.
This is great stuff. We could stop here. No, just kidding. But you've hit on all cylinders. But let me come back though and challenge you with one thing. As a woman writing in this genre, there seems to be we're going to talk about silos. Your books very prominently say a mystery. They don't say a thriller. Mm-hmm. They say a mystery. Do you think that there is a push, out there? You know, maybe it's conscious. Maybe, you know, like I said, you know, agents and publishers, you know, they have their own world, you know, to really kind of nudge women towards this thriller label. Rather than mystery, because if they keep in the mystery lane, it's going to smack too much like a cozy. You know, that word mystery might smack too much like a cozy for women. You know, you see what I'm saying? I mean, do you think there's something there? Because you basically are writing a mystery, but you've got, it's noir and it's hard boiled. However, you know, you just, again, you know, and then again, I'm just putting it out here because it's a podcast and we have to talk about this. There seems to be, not an aversion, but a kind of a lane change where women, you know, writers and audiences move away from that mystery label unless it's a cozy and everybody's writing a thriller. And then if it's a thriller, it's not about, a protagonist that you'd see in a noir hard-boiled. It's somebody who is a good mother, but has all these forces lined up against her, and there's twists and turns, and she's got to anticipate who her enemies are. But she is a good mother, and she is probably a good person, and she didn't have these difficulties. I mean, do you see where I'm coming from here? I mean, am I inventing a conspiracy theory like last night in the State of the Union where there wasn't any? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I'm thinking about it. I think that there are.
I told you I put you on the spot, right?
You are. You're totally putting me on the spot. You know, but I do think that there are certain types of thrillers that kind of they push that women get pushed towards, especially the kind of the domestic side of things. You know, lots of like, you know, her husband's acting funny. Is he a murderer? I don't know how much that is kind of market related versus audience related. I think people have very different expectations of women writers versus male writers. Right. Like, especially the really hard boiled stuff. You don't see as many women's names, and you don't hear as many women talked about, which doesn't mean that they're not writing it. But I would not be surprised if at a publishing level, if someone showed up with, you know, a Jordan Harper style novel, and I'm not saying they're Jordan Harper because there's only one of him.
There is.
But if a woman showed up with a Jordan Harper novel, I think it might be, you know, where, you know, someone's losing an eye or pretend I didn't say that might be a spoiler, but you know, there's, you know, you got a torture scene here and this, right. And it's very, very gruesome. I think that would be a tough sell. I think that you're probably expected to pull back a little bit. And I think there's probably more pressure to fit into a box, whether it be the cozy box or whether it be the domestic expense box. I think there's more pressure to say in the same way that for when you're building a character, you have to kind of justify it. I think the book has to kind of say, okay, well, marketing wise, this is what this is. You know, it's a cozy or it's something else or it's a traditional mystery. You know, ideally there's a, you know, librarian in a quaint English town who, you know, finds a body in the rectory. But I definitely do think that maybe there's a little bit less flexibility in terms of what you're putting out into the world if it's kind of experimental and different.
Right. Because, you know, again, it really, the hook I was looking at was, you know, again, just the covers, you know, and mystery, and mm-hmm. and there is a school of thought. And again, not me. I'm just trying to report out what's out there, and you know, and discuss it. That might think if it's a female author and it doesn't say thriller, and it's a female author and it says mystery, there are going to be certain people who are going to automatically assume, okay, maybe this is some kind of cozy if it says mystery.
Oh yeah, and I've been. Pieces of advice that I got was with, you know, finding a pen name, because I changed the spelling of my name slightly, was keep something androgynous, because a lot of men don't think that they would enjoy a female writer, you know, which I think that's becoming, I'd like to think that that's becoming less true, but, you know, I think that people expect something less dark for women. I'm always pleasantly surprised if I pick up a book by a woman author and it's like really dark and gruesome. And I shouldn't be, because there's no reason to think that it wouldn't be. But I think, you know, and you're unconsciously, we're kind of trained to assume that, you know, women writers are going to be putting something out there that's a little bit more prettied up.
Well, let me switch gears then to the books specifically. I mean, you've got two characters, one in each who, I mean, I'm not going to say they're MacGuffins. They're not, but they are vehicles in a way. One's Margot in the first one, the other's Abby in the second one, more or less. I mean, did you look at them as vehicles? Or are they, you know, to really move the story and really challenge the character, or are they real flesh and blood, visceral people in and of themselves? You know, what were your thoughts going into that?
Oh yeah. I mean, they're both the victims. They're both dead. But right. I like to have flashbacks from the victim's perspective, because especially like I keep killing beautiful women and I need to stop. You know, I'm mad at myself every time I just killed another beautiful woman and I'm working on killing a fourth. So, you know, we all have our bad habits, but
I hope there's nobody roaming around here from Beret who you had a beef with that is being continually killed.
No, you know, I do. There are some people from my past who like they might make some appearances. I'm not going to say I won't get in trouble. But, you know, I think if, especially given the, you know, the history of, you know, of the genre, I don't want to just have somebody where like, you know, okay, well, whatever, she's dead. She's just the stereotypical, you know, lipstick body. But, and I also want people to care that someone's dead. So, you know, so it's like, okay, fine. You know, I have a paragraph worth of background information and a body and now, you know, 200 pages about who killed her. Well, you know, I want to kind of give her a voice. I want to make her unique. You know, and I want people to care about why she's dead. And I think, but also for both of those characters, they served kind of a specific plot function. Like with Margot, I want to write about the art world. Cause I went to art school. I did painting. I worked in a gallery. You know, and I guess on the one hand, it's a it's a nightmare of a world. And also, you know, from a strategic standpoint, I wanted to put a book out there, and I'm a prosecutor who went to art school. So I, you know, that I needed to be able to show why I'm connected to the book. So there's a lot of chapters from Margot's perspective. You know, she's a psychopath, borderline, but there's a lot of her that's based on me, the way she thinks about art. You know, her, she's got kind of a mean, salty sense of humor. So, you know, she was kind of there because it let me talk about the art world. And then right. Abby is, she's a former actress who, and she ends up going to social, changing her life, going to social work school. And she's trying to help her brother, who has this meth addiction and becomes, you know, more and more insane as the book goes on. And I wanted to talk, I wanted to bring in how families are affected by the meth crisis. So I wanted, and I had her perspective. I also had her sister a little bit, who takes a totally different approach to their brother when he kind of goes off the deep end, which is something that I would see all the time in court. You would see families torn apart where you have, you know, one family member who says, you know, I hate him, I'm done, why are we dealing with this? And you have another family member who is, you know, devoting all of their waking energy into trying to help someone. So, you know, for her, it was, you know, a way to both get people to care about the victim and also a way to kind of talk about a different angle of this crisis.
Right. Well, does the story come to you first and then you want to fit these issues in, or do you think about these issues first? Or does it all come together like in a big pot all at once? What are your thoughts on that?
Probably the issues, kind of the stuff I'm thinking about, and I try to throw it in together. Like with Burn This Night, I would help if I remember the title of my own book, right? I was like, what's that called? But with Burn This Night, I was thinking a lot about. I was thinking about meth. I was thinking a lot about kind of DNA and, you know, the like solving cold case crimes. I was thinking a lot about kind of misconnections, I think, and people trying to connect and not being able to, because there's a lot of characters in the book who are decent human beings and just, you know, wired differently or have a different set of beliefs and are just not able, especially within families, and are just not able to come together despite their best intentions. And I kind of had all these ideas in my head, and I really wanted to write a book that involved siblings, where one of them ended up going down this drug crisis. And then I kind of needed to build a plot around that. And I also had a place in mind for that book, because I had been staying in this beautiful mountain town while we were doing some work on our house. And it was just, you know, I would walk around the town and it was really just idyllic and pretty. And it felt like, but at the same time, it was a place with a really substantial fire risk. And that's something that we would live with in Southern California. There's this
right. Yeah.
Very, you know, it sounds cynical if I say very noir, but, you know, very, very real and present juxtaposition of extreme beauty and charm and the constant possibility that, you know, Mother Nature will go wrong and the whole place is going to burn down. And my town, I lived in Sierra Madre. It was very, very close to Altadena. We were evacuated for 6 weeks, you know, and that was not the first time we evacuated either. So it was something that we lived with. I just, and I wanted to bring that setting in as just, you know, that sense of, you know, this is part of Southern California. Like you talk about LA noir, it's, you know, it's not just, you know, strung out wannabe actresses and, you know, two bit con men and right. You know, ugly strip malls. Like there right. are, there's other threads to Southern California that I kind of wanted to bring in.
Well, yeah. Cause I mean, the town in the second book was not, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, you know, nor was it a stop on a kind of the road book. You know, we talk about Jordan Harper. It wasn't a stop on the road to doing something to get away from somebody or to get at somebody. It was right there near Los Angeles, really. Right. I mean, you know, okay. So let me ask you this. Well, first of all, you know, be careful because you're up there in the Pacific Northwest and, you know, my nephew keeps saying there's going to be a big tsunami there soon. You know, he's into that kind of stuff. So, so watch it.
Or a volcano, you know,
or a volcano. Yeah. Those two mountains up there are actually volcanoes. I didn't know that till I was like old, like I am. I thought they were just mountains, like Mount Rainier and Mount Hood or volcanoes.
Yeah, I mean, given my luck, it's going to erupt tomorrow because I, you know, but yeah.
You know, well, don't be on the beach, you know, that'll be. But when you were a prosecutor, though, you talked about these issues, you talked about fleshing out these characters and these backstories and getting to see that they were whole people. However, I mean, you're in the DA's office. I mean, isn't the whole point to kind of, for lack of a better term, stifle your empathy? I mean, you know, aren't you, don't you have to become somewhat of a weapon, a weapon for righteousness or the law, but I mean, a weapon still, I mean, you know, is that a thing? Or did it help you develop even more empathy and more ability to dig down deep because you had to have this kind of laser focus?
When I was at when a prosecutor's office is functioning correctly, I think it's the latter because, you know, there are certain crimes that are just horrific. You know, I people love to say they don't believe in evil. I believe in evil for sure. Some people are evil, but a lot of people are not. A lot of people do bad things. A lot of people do stupid things. A lot of people do desperate things. And most crimes fall into that category. And, you know, when I was at the DA's office, what you would hear over and over and over again was do the right thing. It was a mantra. It was, you know, I remember hearing before my interview with the DA at the time, Jackie Lacey, who I had tremendous respect for, that she cared, you know, she had started a lot of, special courts for, you know, people who had, you know, had done, you know, kind of lesser things and was very into, justice and proportionality as opposed to just bringing down the hammer. And especially, you know, when you start out, you're doing a lot of lower level crimes and, you know, you see desperate situations. You also see people who've done bad things and who are decent human beings. Like I remember having one case where, it was a very low level misdemeanory type conduct not by the parents involved. So it was charged as like a misdemeanor child abuse. And the dad, he had a very significant violent past. Got out of prison, he got somebody pregnant with twins, completely turned his life around, was raising those boys, doing everything he could, got a pardon. He was a very decent human being. And, you know, despite having this past and, you know, I remember having, we had a minor celebrity come in and talk to a group of defendants at one point, who sort of implied that, you know, when he was in prison, he may have been responsible for the death of a prison guard. Read whatever you want from that. But, you know, this is person who, you know, is wealthy and has made it. And I'm not going to say anything else because I'm going to get myself in trouble. But
no, fine. That could be a lot of people out in LA.
It could be a lot of people, but was also, you know, donating all this time and giving back, decades later, and obviously, you know, had these really good threads to who they were. So I think when you're in a good office, you develop more empathy. When you talk to a lot of good policemen, and look, we all know that there's a spectrum, they're definitely the ones who I think of who I have a lot of respect for. It's the same thing. You know, you see people if you see people regularly who are talking about the worst thing that's ever happened to them, and I don't see how you can't not become more empathetic and put things into proportion more, I think, when you're in that kind of environment. And there are other prosecution offices, you know, certainly one that I previously worked in where it's more of a everybody's a hammer mentality, where it's, I think, you know, to me, that's where things are not being done right because you're in the business of justice. You're not in the business of, you know, trying to destroy people.
Well, did the experience help you? Let's just say, would your writing process and creating the plots, the characters, the backstories, would it have been easier had you been a defense attorney?
I think it would be different. I think that's a great background. I know, I mean, Wes Brown, I know you've interviewed. Yeah. Great storyteller, former, I think, current defense attorney, I have no doubt that that, you know, makes him a better writer. But I think it's probably kind of similar. You know, it's a similar world. You get different perspectives. You know, we talk to victims and witnesses. They talk to defendants. But it's the same thing. You get in the habit of seeing someone as a whole person. And, you know, also, you know, you're exposed to a lot more, you know, of kind of dark things that can happen to a person. You know, you're not kind of stuck in this little box of like everything is fine and, you know, nobody does drugs and nobody has one too many beers yeah. in a car. You know.
Yeah, I know some people who were prosecutors with, you know, just, you know, federal and you know, here, state, if you want to call it, and defense attorneys. And the interesting thing, and of course, not all of them are authors. I mean, virtually, it's not just none. They might have something they're hiding on their computer at work, though, from their bosses. But for me, what I've seen is, I came up with this theory from talking to Wes, believe it or not, is that the ones who were defense attorneys, when they create these plots and these characters, there is usually a protagonist who is a criminal. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, is a criminal. But this person, you know, is a whole person, and there are reasons why they're doing this. And there's usually somebody else who is a worse criminal. Whereas the people who come from the prosecutorial, you know, the state background, there's usually that one person, and they have a lot of dimensions to them that are really awful and are really really good. And I call it the Godzilla and Monster Zero thing, because it seems like the defense attorneys, when they come up with a story, there's, you know, I'm talking about Godzilla now, and we're going to deep dive nerd shit right now. But, you know, Godzilla now, who's a monster, but he's our monster. I mean, he fucks up everything, but, you know, he does draw a line, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, King Ghidorah, Monster Zero, who doesn't give a fuck and will just murder everybody. So that's, you see what I'm saying? There seems to be, there's a protagonist who is definitely a criminal, but there's always some worse bastard out there. Whereas the people who come from, you know, the more prosecutorial or corporate lawyer or whatever background or writing a story, it's usually somebody who has a lot of facets, but they don't have that. There isn't that point counterpoint going on. And I attribute that to them in practice, where they have dealt with people. They've represented people who, as you said, are basically good people that have been backed in a corner.
Yeah.
You know, and are you know, either lashing out or doing whatever they can to put food on the table. And yes, then there are other people who are out there who are truly evil. And, you know, go ahead.
I think they get really, really in tune to knowing the difference and knowing that where people fall on the spectrum. And
right.
I think that's a huge advantage for if you're writing noir. For me, there's a line, and if it's you see it a lot with TV shows where you like Sons of Anarchy. It was very entertaining when it starts out. There was a point where everybody just got too evil, and I didn't care if they all died. It was like, okay, well, you know, maybe if the rival games just come in with machine guns and take them out, because I'm done. And I think that probably a lot of readers have that. Like, well, you need that thread of redemption, and if you don't have it, you're just totally lost. And I suspect that if you're a defense attorney, you're working with people all day, you kind of know the difference. And you also know what good part of a person's character and story to push, you know, whether it's to a jury, whether it's to try to get leaning right from the other side. So, you know, I think that's a huge, huge advantage. And then I think we have a lot of that on our side, too. We make our own decisions. It's like, when do you give someone a break? When right. is something completely irredeemable? You know, I did a lot of domestic violence cases where, I mean, honestly, there's not a lot of room for redemption in that,
no.
in that region. You know, you see the difference between some of those cases and, you know, some case where, you know, someone got desperate and broke into a house because they got to feed their family. You can't be doing that, you know, but it's not the same thing as someone who has, you know, been terrorizing this woman and basically turned her into a prisoner. So you start understanding a little bit of the difference. And I think, you know, probably on our side, we understand a lot about investigation. You know, we're not cops, but we know how to put a case together. We know what to look into. And on the defense side, you know, there's a huge advantage to really getting the firsthand story of somebody who's made horrific choices and whose life has totally fallen apart. And when you're putting a book together, you rely on your advantages. You know, you're saying, you might say, okay, well, I know a lot about this process, so I'm going to write about this. Or you might say, like, you know, maybe on the defense side, you're thinking about a particular person or a particular, you know, type of situation that your clients go through, and you want to write about that. So, you know, definitely, I think I don't think any of us bring in specific cases. You mean, right. That's a big no-no. But in terms of like generalized experiences, you know, you bring in, you write what you know.
Well, let me just ask you this then. And this is just going to be kind of a rolling kind of thing. And let's go to Kate then. Why didn't you make her a prosecutor? You know, or why didn't you make her a cop and turn it into a police procedural?
Oh, she started out as a male cop.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then honestly, it was.
But why didn't you just turn it? You know, because you know you've got other writers who have whole. You know, look at Tracy Clark. You know,
yeah.
You know, with
this fantastic
character that runs right through, and it's all that police procedural juiciness. Why didn't you just leave it like that?
Well, I think in part when I started writing the series, it was just nobody was interested in police procedurals. I mean, there had been a lot of
fair enough. That's a good answer.
Horrific killings in the news. Nobody wanted to read about good cops. It was not happening. And I think at the same time, I kind of got to a point where I knew both too much and too little. So I felt like to write a police procedural, like I talked to cops all the time. You read the police reports, I know the generals, but then I knew what I didn't know. And I think if I didn't come from a law enforcement background, I would just write it. It's a good story. Nobody really cares about the nuances of how to get a warrant. But right. I was kind of too in the weeds and not in the weeds enough. So I wanted somebody who understood investigations, but also was not, you know, not having to rely on the nitty gritty of like what exactly a crime scene should look like. So she was kind of one degree removed. And then I think also just, I hadn't really thought about writing a prosecutor. I just finished a book and sent to my agent, which is focused on a prosecutor.
Okay.
That was kind of a fun thing to do, but I'm not particularly interested in writing about myself. Like I'm more interested in other people and you know, creating a character who's, you know, gone through different challenges. So, you know, I didn't really necessarily want to go the prosecution route at the time. Plus, I guess I didn't want to put myself in a situation where I was like talking smack about an office where I'm like,
right.
Maybe I was still there. You know, like I have a character who may or may not be based on a former coworker with, you know, specific tattoo details. You know, I wouldn't necessarily want to have that as a prosecutor.
Especially, you know, in Southern California, excuse me, when that's so many high profile cases and, you know, prosecutors there just drag through the mud for being either incompetent or too hammer-like, you know, one or the other, you know, I totally understand that. Do you think that it would have been also limiting? I mean, let's look at the lawyer thing. I mean, that's been done obviously so many times, but I mean, would it have to have turned into almost, a kind of sexual thriller or something like that? Because you know, people are bored by, you know, getting a warrant,
right.
Sitting down and drafting pleadings, you know, from basically forms. Nobody cares about that. But, you know, if two prosecutors are working late and they have sex on the desk at night after work, that sells. I mean, you didn't really want to go near that? Or I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think if you're going to write a book based on prosecutors, something has to go wrong and they have to, like, there has to be a reason that they're not doing things they should be doing, which is kind of the one I just finished, that's kind of the way I was going in. Because if everybody's doing things the way they're supposed to, like it's not, it should be routine. It should be boring. You shouldn't be, right. You know, running off to talk to a witness all alone at midnight with a handgun and, you know, like, nah, it should be, you know, very, very buttoned up. So if you're, I think there aren't that many books that focus on prosecutors, I think for that reason. And if you can, you have to kind of come up with the right plot to explain why this person is, you know, going kind of out of the norm. But, you know, you're right in that you can't just be a standard book of, you know, and then I ran court and I did pleas in 20 cases and then it was lunchtime. You know, that's not good fiction.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, it would have to either take some political diversion or the prosecutor would have to be, you know, a serial killer or, you know, doing meth in the office or something like that. Yeah. I mean, it would be, that's a little, you know, that's not to say that doesn't happen.
Oh, no, that happened
in real life. But, well, I know you've probably been asked this question before, but I just for tick off my list here. When you're painting, is it a different part of your brain than when you're writing? I'm looking at, it's a very trite and trope question, but I think people just seem to want to hear that. I mean, you know, and I'm sure you're tired of answering it, but is there a difference? I mean,
It's very related. I think it changes how you approach things. You know, I would say that writing is probably in some ways easier. I was never quite good enough at drawing to, you know, take it beyond the kind of school level. And you don't have that hurdle with writing. So that's very freeing. But, you know, you're thinking about, you know, what is the most dynamic way to present something? And you're thinking about what is a dynamic idea that you want to present? And all of that is there. And I think editing for me is very similar to painting. It's like when you paint, you get the general thing on the canvas and then you have to just keep refining it and keep going back until it looks right. And I think I'm a very obsessive editor, even though I never notice typos. It's terrible. You would think it was
that way too. Based on my
typo number. But in terms of like word choice, you know, I mean, I am obsessive. And I think that probably comes from painting of just, you know, trying to take something and refine it and make it as, you know, make sure that every corner of it is, I hate the word impactful and I almost said it. So, but as, you know, just packs as much punch as possible.
Do you, and this is a lot of left field question. I mean, do you impart that methodology to your kid in terms of what stuff he's doing? I mean, he's just a kid and you don't want to unkid him. I mean, you know, make him obsessive. I mean, but do you either consciously or unconsciously try to impart that approach that, you know, try to get the broad swaths down, but then just charge in later and really form it up, or do you just let her rip? I mean,
it's triage. You know, I got one's turning 5 tomorrow. The other one's 19 months. Neither of them sleeps, both super high energy. No, I try to keep them alive and happy. That's pretty much my goal.
Right. Right. Yeah. You're not going down. Yeah. We you haven't gotten those specifics quite.
No,
I have the luxury of those yet.
Make them eat fruit because it's really not socially acceptable to have scurvy at the age of 5. Right. You know, that's about as detailed as I get.
Well, but one of them is old enough, I mean, to create, to draw, to write, you know, I mean, is it important to kind of tell them at this stage, you know, just get the basics down. You can always come back and really make it what you want, or just, you know, is that too advanced, do you think?
I haven't thought about it in those terms. I definitely encourage the storytelling. Is the big one for sure he's got the verbal gene. I mean, he'll at the 4th of July, he said the fireworks look like sea anemones. You know, he's got all kinds of, you know, he'll come up with, he'll bust out kind of similes and metaphors and I don't know where they come from. And, you know, I remember when he was little, he said his friend when he got mad, burned with a fire that's hard to stamp out, which I'm pretty sure he got from his teacher, who was, but I don't know. So, there is a verbal.
He has a better vocabulary than most of the people about a mile from my office right here in DC.
Yeah, no, he's a little scary in that department, but that I try to encourage, you know, even though all our stories are going to be told by AI by the time he's an adult, but
right.
You know, the storytelling, the imagination, you know, I try to encourage that. We tell stories, we read lots of books, and, you know, we're currently working on the not lying, and stories are different from just pretending that you have a stomach ache all the time, but that's a work in process.
Yeah, that getting back to DC, I mean, that's... I don't envy any parents of any young children having to deal with that, given what's going on among the adults in charge here, you know. But that's, again, that's another story. I don't have a political podcast. I should, but I would probably lose all my hair. But do you where do you see yourself in terms of moving? You know, are you going to continue to challenge Kate, or are you going to move? You just delivered this manuscript.
Yeah.
You know, do you think you might try a cozy? You know, I was at an event this summer with Laura Lippman, and she wrote mm-hmm. one. And you try a domestic suspense thriller. I mean, you know, hey, you know,
yeah.
There might be some of those stories where you were working late at night, you heard some grunts and groans in the cubicle down the road there from your fellow prosecutors. Do you see yourself doing anything like that?
I'm not a cozy girl. Not throwing shade. Some of those books are fabulous.
Oh yeah. And, yeah.
You know, I have a dark sensibility, and I'm interested in human psychology. And I think that you need to put people in difficult situations to kind of see how they react and kind of learn about, you know, what happens to a person if this is going on, and then you throw this in. So, you know, I'm always going to have a pretty high level of mind fuckery, if that's,
yeah.
But
no, that works.
Yeah. And so, the last one I turned in, it's a standalone. It's not Kate related. I'm working on like three different ones now that are all totally different. And right. I haven't yet for a fourth. So, you know, I can't say that there isn't necessarily one world that feel like I'm going to be devoted to. Like, I have got three totally different worlds kind of going on right now. I'm just trying to figure out which one I want to finish. And I do want to sort of maintain that freedom, because I think I write better when I create a scenario where I go into it thinking, how the F am I going to pull this off? And I don't think my ADHD brain does well when something is kind of set up easy is the wrong word, but where it's just like, okay, well, this world exists and these are the characters, and now just put in a plot, I kind of shut down. So I think I'm probably going to be going off on a lot of tangents, because it's just kind of how I think and how I work.
I was asking because with my last little missive about the cubicles down the way, I mean, if you were really thinking about mind fuckery, I mean, maybe domestic suspense as an experiment yeah. might be something, you would be good at. I mean, bringing the noir flavor to it, it certainly needs it. You know, that would be interesting. I mean, I certainly, would go out and rush out and get that, you know.
Yeah.
You're dipping your toe in that more so than a cozy. I couldn't see you writing a cozy unless we totally changed the whole definition of that term.
You never know. I would love to try out some of my favorite books, though, that I think that I read are like, if you take just the whole suspense, the whole book is kind of based around just the dynamics between two or three characters, and how that there's almost like a, oh God, what's that book called? Like, if I think about like Broiler is, I think,
right,
one of the,
right.
it's astonishing.
Right.
It really is. The book is based around the dynamic between these four characters and this like insane situation that's set up, which incidentally was like the first book I read to my baby, which is probably a little messed up given that.
It wasn't a Jordan Harbor
Oh God! I read, you know, I read
on audio yet with the speaker on your stomach. That would have been great.
Well, but you know, but I think I feel like for me, I do better when I have a lot of content, like a lot of content. Like I don't think I am as I love books that kind of like zero in on that, but I think that I just function better with a lot of moving pieces. So maybe I'll try to domestic suspense and like I love that stuff. But I'm not sure if it's necessarily where I'm focusing now.
Well, let me, we're heading almost to the end here. And I just wanted to ask, do you, what do you think about, you know, our community? I mean, I started off saying, you know, the two things, you know, that I really wanted to get you on the show was, you know, first that, you know, you represented the future and that subset of the future of women really writing noir and hard boiled. And the second was that you were just an absolutely great person. It seems surreal to me sometimes that there are so many absolutely great people.
There are. It's, yeah.
You know, and you and I coming from legal backgrounds, I mean, that's even more surreal, you know, when you...
No one's going to say that about lawyers.
And most of us are actually fairly normal people.
Yeah.
I never understood, although the opposite was, I never understood why they had all that crap, you know, before you took the bar exam where they had to examine whether you were a monster or not, because most mm-hmm. people... became monsters after passed the bar, not before. I mean, what's the use of screening them out, right. You know, earlier, you know? But it is amazing to me, the camaraderie and the supportiveness of the community. You know, even though you do have little pods of people, you know, that congregate on, and then there's cross pollinations here and there. But I mean, did you anticipate that, or did that take you by surprise, or did it just kind of grow on you?
Oh no, totally. Maybe by surprise. I don't have very high expectations for like human nature. You know, whether it just be maybe from my, you know, my day job and from being a lawyer. But it's, I did not expect at all. And I would say every time I hear, which is rare, an anecdote about a crime writer not being lovely, that's what takes me by surprise.
Yeah.
You know, because people are so welcoming and unpretentious, you know, and it was interesting because the other day I was talking to like my kid's friend's dad. He said, was talking about the heavy metal community, which I don't know anything about. I'm more of a, you know, country song singer, right. Girl. But he was saying that those guys, when you meet them, they are the nicest people on the planet. And it made me think, because they deal with really dark material, and we deal with really dark material.
Yeah.
And, you know, and honestly, you know, in the prosecution world, I mean, like we got some psychopaths, but for the most part, you deal with dark material, dark stuff, and you deal with, and people tend to be really lovely. You know, as far as lawyers go. But I don't know what it is, if it's that when people have kind of, maybe it's an outlet for, you know, darker thoughts, or maybe if it's just you develop kind of a gallows humor and a different perspective when you're dealing with dark material a lot. But, you know, it seems like that kind of just that camaraderie and niceness and down to earthness kind of maybe extends into other areas also that kind of deal with, you know.
Do you think it's because a lot of us did something else before we did this, or we're still doing? You know, we didn't decide, okay, I'm going to take all these English courses, be an English major and get my MFA and write the great American novel, that we actually went out and into the world and let the world pound on us. And you know, do you think that maybe kind of made us less, I wouldn't say less pretentious, because I'm a pretty pretentious person, but I mean, more, you know, just more receiving and giving of people. I mean, do you think that might be it? Or that was my theory, at least.
I think that there's a certain amount of empathy that comes with what you're doing. I mean, you're sitting here trying to put yourself into another person's position. And you're also trying to put yourself into another person's position while terrible things are happening to them, and thinking, you know, and feeling for that person and presenting that person's story. That if you're able to do that well, then you have a certain kind of mind that tends to, you know, to go in empathetic directions. So I think that's part of it. And I think it's also for a lot of us, it's like, you know, suddenly it's like you're 35 or you're 50 and you just got invited to a birthday party for the first time. It's like, you know, you like you said, you go out into the world, you get pounded on, you have all these other experiences. You probably always feel a little bit like an outsider for most of us. Right. You know, a lot of us are a little bit neurotypical while also intelligent, which is really confusing bitch of a combo. And then all of a sudden, you're in this room with people who think like you and have similar interests. And it's this kind of an unexpected treat where it makes you a little bit humble and it maybe makes you a little bit, I guess, more generous just with your time and your energy than you might be in other sectors of your life.
Yeah, my moment was New Orleans when a certain Edgar Winter brought his moonshine.
Oh my God. I know. I'm bummed I didn't get to try it. That I heard about that.
It was pineapple and lemon flavored.
and nobody went blind. So that's a plus.
You know, and here is, and, you know, he was on my show. and I was sitting there going, you know, my dumbass said, I he must have brought it on the plane. I'm like, no, he didn't bring it on the airplane unless they were using it to power the plane to get to New Orleans. But, now Henry's great, but I mean only at something like that would you see that. But Alex, I got to tell you, fellow Washingtonian, daughter of Swift Potomac, we are out of time here, but I am so happy you were able to join us again. Alex Kenna, just the future of noir, pass the torch. And again, this is Chris Chambers Noir. We are here on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. You can see our bright smiling faces, and Incandescent Radio. I want to thank Alex Kenna for really making this a joyous hour, and I hope you guys take something away from this, because she's going to be the grand dame one day, and she can, she'll tell her son is going to be, he's going to be in his 50s. She goes, I talked to Chris Chambers on that old platform. I forgot what it is. Now you have images floating in the air and AI, but it was fun. So thank you guys, and have a great day.
Thank you all. Yes, Alex, that was awesome, scary, and fantastic. And as my kids are grown up now, so good luck, have fun. You never know who they're going to grow into be. So
yes, cool. That is true. My main goal is that he doesn't grow up to be an asshole. So
hey, that's exactly what I said about my kids. It's the goal. All right, you guys, thank you to all of our viewers, listeners, and readers. This is Chris Chambers Noir. And check him out. ChrisChambersNoir.com is his website. And check out Alex's books. They sound fascinating. This is Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and all those other cool places that Chris talked about. We will see you again next month. Have a great day.